This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At 5,525 miles, the border between the U.S. and Canada is the longest and pretty much the friendliest in the world. Relations between the two nations are generally cheery, apart from the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, assorted dust-ups, a misunderstanding over the shooting of a pig, and that episode of West Wing, when a standoff between some hunters and Mounties escalated into an international incident.
Enough. This is stopping now. The problem is not a few rowdy outlaws from a bygone era blowing off testosterone. The problem is us. We're still the wild bunch. I mean, the higher it goes, the hotter the risk. I just threatened the Canadian ambassador.
Well, once again, truth may be stranger than fiction. It turns out that there have been a few scrapes and some bad blood between the rowdy U.S. and its polite northern neighbor. In fact, both the U.S. and Canada have plans on the books for full-scale war and seizure of each other's major cities. The American military plan was drawn up in the 1930s and is called War Plan Red, also the title of a slim and humorous little history by Kevin Lippert. The subtitle, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. Kevin Lippert, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
I really did think this was a joke, like something from the plot of Infinite Jest. But it's funny that the history of conflicts between the U.S. and Canada exists and lies in the very foundation of both nations. They were originally one set of North American colonies. Why the split?
Well, after the Revolutionary War, and America felt that they had won the war, when they had the peace treaty negotiations in Paris, Benjamin Franklin had an idea which was, as long as we won the war, why don't you give us all of North America, including the Canadian provinces? The British at first agreed to that, but then backed off from that position and drew an imaginary line through the woods. These were days when the land just had not been explored, so they drew a line across the 47th and then later the 49th parallel and left it for later to actually locate the exact position of the border. So there was a lot of ambiguity about where the border was, and that led to numerous border tensions between the two countries.
Which really escalated in the War of 1812, when American troops thought that they would be welcomed as liberators as they invaded Quebec. They were not. What happened?
Well, after the Treaty of Paris and the Revolutionary War, there were a lot of Americans who felt that somehow Canada was still owed to them. Among these, Henry Clay, who was an early Kentucky hothead, and President Madison at that time thought it would be easy, just a matter of marching, he said, an easy thing to march in and take over Canada. So during the Revolutionary War, the states had invaded Quebec because they assumed that the Canadians, like the Americans, would be eager to throw off the British. And they had that same assumption at least twice in the War of 1812. But some Canadians I spoke to in doing the research for the book feel that the War of 1812 was the war that cemented a Canadian sense of national identity. That was when foreigners invaded their territory, in this case the Americans, and that brought the British and the French closer together to repel the invasions.
Let's talk about some of these border skirmishes through the years. Wonderfully named Pork and Beans War of 1839. This is, as you put it, the only time in our history that an American state went to war with a foreign country. First, why the name?
Well, this was a war between lumberjacks in Maine and New Brunswick. And since pork and beans was the favorite food of lumberjacks, it became known as the Pork and Beans War. It's also known as the Roostock War, named after the Roostock County in Maine. Because of the fuzziness about the border between Maine and New Brunswick, lumberjacks from both countries or states and countries would routinely pass back and forth cutting down each other's trees. And there was one day when the Mainers had had enough. They invaded New Brunswick and they were promptly captured by the Canadians and put in chains and taken off to prison. And this caused an uproar in Washington. Lots of men were mobilized. $10 million was authorized to declare war on Canada. And at that point, the British ambassador said, there's nothing worth fighting over here. So he gave a lot of territory to the United States to resolve that conflict without a shot.
Another escalation to international incident without a shot, the shooting of a pig in 1859. What happened here?
This is the same story, just on the other side of the country. One of the places that was also poorly defined was San Juan Island off the coast of Washington State and Vancouver. And both British and Americans occupied that territory to try and take it as, claim it as their own. There were some American farmer squatters, and on the other side of the island, the Hudson's Bay Company, which was, of course, the giant trading, fur trapping corporation, British corporation that owned pretty much all of Western Canada, and including some of the eastern provinces and bits and pieces of Minnesota. So they owned an astonishing 3,000 square miles, and including, they thought, the Vancouver Island. One day, a British pig was rooting in the garden of an American farmer who shot the pig, and this caused what I liken to a Falklands-like buildup. The British sent in a bunch of warships. We sent in more warships and more troops. And then finally, their order came from Britain to attack the Americans. The British admiral said, to have two great nations go to war over a pig is ridiculous. So he declined the order, and that war was also happily resolved without any loss of life.
Except for the
pig. So that one's called the Pig War, except for the pig.
But you know, it sounds like a sort of history of, I don't know, incompetence, of almost playing Risk in some kind of way.
Yes.
What's
going
on?
And nowhere
there?
Was there more incompetence than in the War of 1812, where American soldiers launched a series of ill-fated raids into Canada, most of which were ended tragically for the Americans. And including maybe the most humorous was the after the Civil War, there was a group of Irish Americans who formed what they called the Fenian Brotherhood, and they also called themselves the Irish Republican Army, the first known use of the acronym IRA. Their idea was to invade Canada and exchange it as a hostage with Britain for the freedom of Ireland. So there were numerous Fenian raids across the border, one of which was semi-successful but only encouraged more unsuccessful raids.
Why on earth would the U.S. want to invade Canada? Well, turns out that on a number of occasions, that question has been, why not? Kevin Lippert is with us. He's author of War Plan Red, the United States' secret plan to invade Canada, and Canada's secret plan to invade the United States. Okay, so you were born in Leeds, England. Your mother is a naturalized Canadian citizen, and you live in the U.S. now. What is it that we just don't get here in the U.S. about Canada? First of all, thinking that you could trade Canada for Ireland as if you were playing some kind of game. What are we missing here? Why don't we get it?
I'm not sure we ever got past the idea that somehow Canada doesn't belong to us. And toward the end of the book, I talk about War Plan Rumsfeld, the sort of post-9/11 political reality of how America basically took control of the Canadian military. And I don't think it was ever debated. I think there was just an assumption that Canada is sometimes called America's hat. Canada sits right next door to us. Since World War II, they've been under our shield, our umbrella of nuclear deterrence. So I think there's just a sense that somehow Canada belongs to the States and we can more or less do with it as we like.
Well, relations are much better between the U.S. and Canada than certainly they were during the Pork and Beans War. But now we have this alliance, the NORAD alliance, centered in a bunker. What can you tell us about this secret alliance?
Canada made a superhuman contribution to World War II, and I think that was something I was never aware of, that 1 million out of 11 million Canadians served in World War II, and from thin air they created the world's fourth largest Air Force and the world's fifth largest Navy. So they really stepped up to the plate and were a big factor in the victory in World War II, as a result of which, after the war, when we assumed our next war would be with Russia and not with Great Britain or Canada, Canada was invited to sit at the table with us at NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense, which was our nuclear shield to protect against possible Soviet nuclear attack, in which Canada, probably not a target, but almost certainly collateral damage. And of the two commanding officers at NORAD, one is a Canadian and one is American. So they have equal footing at NORAD, at least. After 9/11, there were a couple of initiatives to expand that military collaboration, which resulted in an expansion of NORAD to include maritime, sea, and also land movements. So the post 9/11 version of NORAD, mm-hmm. the United States and Canada are very much intertwined militarily.
Well, War Plan Rumsfeld was very different than the more covert war plans that were drawn up in the 1930s. This is the War Plan Red. It was declassified in 1974. But it turns out that Canada had drawn up its own plan 10 years earlier, almost like eerily mirroring each other. What were the basics of the plans?
Which they very politely called Defense Scheme Number 1. This was drawn up by Canadian
military.
Wait,
I just have to stop for 1 second. It's defense with a C in that very Canadian way.
Yes, of course.
But how passive aggressive is that to say it's a defense scheme when it's actually an offense scheme?
Well, it depends how, if you think Canadian politeness is passive aggressive, but it was a very passive aggressive scheme. The military officer who drew this up was a World War I vet, and he believed that a war between the United States and Britain was inevitable, and that the best defense would be a good offense. So he drew up a plan that would be a series of kind of blitzkrieg raids across the border, and he and a couple of his buddies had done some espionage in New England and upstate New York. They loaded into a Model T and took their Kodak Brownies and took a lot of pictures of bridges and roads that they were going to blow up as they retreated. His idea was you raid the United States, you withdraw, and that buys time for Britain to sail to your rescue. And that was never obviously acted on. But it's interesting, as you say, that the two plans are really mirror images of one another. I guess we each identified each other's weak points, being, for example, Albany, Sault Ste. Marie, Bellingham, Washington, and we would either attack from there or be attacked at those points.
Well, the United States plan, $57 million was allocated from Congress to follow through on this plan. One of the strategies was to create military airfields and disguise them as civilian airports, for example. So how far did this get?
I think that's as far as it got in terms of actual readying for a war. They built these airfields. They had the largest military exercise in American history to that point was held at Fort Drum. They had 36,000 troops assemble on the Canadian border and have war games for a possible invasion.
I guess the question is, hasn't America on some level already invaded Canada, you know, with television and movies and pop music and sports that aren't hockey?
I think The conclusion of the book is that for all intents and purposes, on many levels, we already are one country, and we've sort of slipped quietly into peace through an invasion of sports, entertainment, and a complete commingling of trade and economics. We are each other's largest trading partner. So we worry in the States a lot about China, but in fact, Canada is a much larger trading partner for us. The border is still friendly and quite porous, and there are millions of people pass every year back and forth between the United States and Canada in both directions. And one interesting statistic I learned in writing the book was that there are 250,000 Canadians who live and work in New York City, which makes it Canada's 15th largest city.
Well, now and again, everybody talks about moving to Canada, you know, whether for free health care or education, or you get 18 months of maternity leave. Is that the
sole... Or to escape some political craziness.
I thought I would let that one go. It's
okay,
been a while.
Well. Now, well, we've got political craziness on the horizon that might prompt any of us to move up to Canada. But I've heard that comment from friends of mine on both ends of the political spectrum. If X is elected, I'm moving to Canada. But if we didn't have that safe haven, where would we go in order to maintain or find our sanity? And there are more concrete reasons besides finding some peace of mind. Canada, it turns out, has the world's second largest supply of oil and 20% of the world's fresh water. So they have some natural resources that we need and a lot of people think will be the subject of a future war. We've already had arguably 4 decades of war over oil, but a lot of people think fresh water will be the source of a next global conflict.
So we better cozy on up to Canada.
We better be nice.
Take some lessons from Canada. Well, Kevin Lippert, thank you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Kevin Lippert is the author of War Plan Red, The United States' Secret Plan to Invade Canada and Canada's Secret Plan to Invade the United States. It's a beautifully designed book, by the way. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Immigration is a key issue among 2016 Republican presidential candidates, a fact which Donald Trump claimed credit for at their first debate on Fox News.
If it weren't for me, you wouldn't even be talking about illegal immigration, Chris. You wouldn't even be talking about it.
Trump, now leading among GOP hopefuls by a wide margin in New Hampshire and Iowa, gave a speech when he launched his campaign saying that Mexico is sending immigrants, bringing drugs, bringing crime. They're rapists. As embarrassing as his remarks were to some in the Republican Party, several of his rivals are now talking decisively about securing the border. That border with Mexico, that is. But will no one dare stand up to immigrants from our northern boundary? Bill Curry is a columnist for Salon, a former Connecticut state senator, and domestic strategist for the Clinton White House. Finally, someone willing to address the growing maple menace.
Republican presidential candidates in New Hampshire are all talking about immigration. 16 good men and a woman who see New Hampshire's need to defend all its borders, not just the one with Vermont, who say what must be said. It's time to crack down on illegal Canadian immigrants. Liberals downplay the crisis. Canadians, they say, do jobs Americans won't do. Park ranger, goalie, microbrewer. But a closer look led social scientists to a startling discovery. Most of our problems are caused by Canadians. It took a while to see it, due to the speed with which Canadians assimilate. Slow in so many other ways, this talent for passing, both on and off the ice, made them virtually invisible to INS agents. An hour in country, and your average Canadian passes easily for a Mainer, or even a Minnesotan. The story of their detection is a public policy legend. When local officials first noticed a rising number of Canadian quarters in Buffalo parking meters, they thought little of it. It was the classic error of failing to assume any trend ticking slightly upward will go on doing so forever. Soon, parking meters across the Northeast were disgorging Canadian quarters like slot machines in a poorly run casino. A big blow to municipalities whose Chinese bankers threatened to, quote, come over there personally and empty the meters ourselves, unquote. The media was calling the crisis overblown. When scholars from the Cato Institute, flying over Canada en route to Bali for a 10-day conference on the upside of global warming, improvised an ingenious study. We looked out the window, said a senior fellow, and saw nothing but trees. It was like they emptied out the whole country. He surmised that crowds in NSA surveillance photos of Montreal were actors hired to conceal the mass migration and also satisfy employment quotas for American films being shot there. 30 million Canadians flooding our job markets kills wages. Compare the salary of an NHL wingman to that of a major league pitcher or NFL running back, and you'll see just what I mean. Most Canadians are English-speaking or American Canadians, but other Canadians, there's no delicate way to put this, are French. Their contempt for our customs and language infect many a workplace. I had a recent frustrating exchange with a Canadian-born physician. Hey, boom, boom, I shouted. Learn the language. The word is copay. Canadian illegals have caused a crime wave not seen since the Irish and Italians first washed up on our shores. From forest hideouts, they run the drug cartels they call internet pharmacies. They recruit couriers called moose to tread the perilous southern trail to senior centers just across the border. Our democracy itself is in peril. Democracy feeds on information, and Canadians are notoriously close-mouthed. Some won't even answer short tracking polls. Pressed, they offer cryptic replies like, "He seems nice," or, I haven't had a chance to read up on that. Can they even sustain the steroidal rage modern politics demands of every citizen? We just don't know. It may be why our founding fathers gave up on the idea of acquiring Canada. They knew our problems all come from other places. We don't have to solve them. Just keep them out.
Bill Curry there, a columnist for Salon and former counselor to the Clinton White House. Historically, staking a claim to an unoccupied parcel of land has been a way to obtain property. Take mid-19th century America, when pioneers took the perilous trek to set up homesteads in the West. Given the swelling of the global population and scramble for resources, you'd think that time was over. But earlier this year, an aspiring Czech politician traveled to a piece of undesirable land wedged between Serbia and Croatia, stuck a flag in the earth, and declared it a new country, the Republic of Liberland. It's easy to write off his bid as a bad joke, but a lot of effort has gone into making Liberland a legitimate country, or at least look the part. Gideon Lewis Krause is a writer and contributor to the New York Times Magazine, where he recently profiled Liberland and its charismatic founder. Gideon, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So usually when land is in dispute, it is because two countries both want it. But no one was claiming this parcel. Why not?
It's true. It's the peculiar case where neither country wants this land. And the history of this is actually extremely complex, and people have written entire books on the subject. So it's not easy just to distill it into a couple of sentences as I had to do in the piece. But the bottom line is that the Danube was used to mark the historical border between Croatia and Serbia. But then the Danube was straightened to allow for long barge traffic. And so it didn't really matter what the border was while they were both neighboring republics of Yugoslavia. But in the 90s, it became an issue over whether one drew the border along where the river used to run or where the river ran now. So it's easier to see on a map. But basically, there are a bunch of chunks of what once was Croatia that are now on the Serbian side. And both Croatia and Serbia want that land because it's something like 150 hectares. I mean, it's a sizable chunk of land. And neither wants to take this much smaller piece of land that's now attached to Croatia. So basically, neither of them wants this small land because they both want more land on the other side.
And this land does have a name in the Croat language, Gornja Siga. Anything there? I mean, what's it like?
After the president declared the foundation of Liberland in early April, for about 3 weeks, he could come and go as he pleased. And there are a lot of videos of him walking around. There's a single lane, rutted, almost unpassable dirt track that leads to the main road in Croatia. And there is an abandoned hunting lean-to that's been there for, they think, I mean, it's been abandoned for about 30 years. Nobody knows who the owner is. So there's really nothing there. And it's mostly marshland. It's prone to seasonal flooding. And they have a terrible mosquito problem.
Well, they were talking about 3 square miles approximately of land.
Right.
And you referred to the president. The president being Vít Jedlička. Tell us about this president of Liberland.
So he is a 31-year-old Czech activist and politician, although he actually, this didn't make it into the article, but his day job is that he makes animated online videos. He studied at an institute in Prague that is devoted to Austrian economics, or the foundation of modern libertarian ideas. And he ran for the European Parliament in the last election on the small Czech Libertarian Party's ticket. But he lost. And he decided in the wake of this loss that he would do what he had wanted to do for a long time, which was establish his own country. So he set about and spent about 2 years looking for a suitable piece of land to establish Liberland.
And Liberland, he's declared as a sort of libertarian, Eurosceptic republic. What's behind this ideologically?
That is a very good question. So he, in his speeches, the broad brush stuff is sort of standard libertarian fare. It's minimal government, no state expenditure on public works. His idea is that all public works would be paid for by a crowdsourcing system like Kickstarter. But beyond that, he does not have very specific ideas about how the state would be run, and that has led to fissuring among his supporters. So one of the arcs of the piece is that I follow him around Europe as he meets with supporters, and essentially he's a pretty good salesman, and he's a very endearing guy, and he is very happy telling different libertarians what they would like to hear. So for some people, he plays up the sort of xenophobia aspect. For other people, he talks about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. So he's more than willing to expand libertarianism to suit a lot of different political viewpoints.
How does one claim ownership over a piece of land like this? Are there any kind of laws governing that?
So he claims that the Montevideo Convention of December 1933 establishes what one has to do to set up one's own republic. And essentially for him, it's just the homestead principle, as you mentioned before, that it's just showing up on an unclaimed piece of land and planting your flag. Now, the Montevideo Convention also stipulates that you have to have a permanent population and you have to have a state that is able to engage in diplomatic relations with other states, even if you're unrecognized. So he claims that actually you don't have to be recognized to be a legitimate state. But so far, because the Croatians won't let them enter the country, he does not have a permanent population and has yet to establish a formal state, although he does have appointed ambassadors all over Europe and the States.
Okay, let's go back to that. Croatia's not letting anyone set foot. How have the governments of Croatia and Serbia responded to Jedlička's efforts?
Well, Serbia released a communique the day after he announced his country that called what he was doing a frivolous act, but basically said that they were prepared to ignore it because it was happening on the Croatian side of the river, and they were happy for it to be Croatia's problem. Croatia declared it a joke, and when President Jedlička tried to approach their foreign minister in Zagreb to talk it over, her bodyguards blocked his advances, and she fled on foot, which is an injury that he has not, even now, is wounding to him.
Well, I mean, is he serious about this? I mean, do you get the sense that he recognizes the absurdity in what he's doing?
Well, when I was in Paris with him, he was speaking to the small French Libertarian Party, and he met with journalists afterward, and then the next day, a French newspaper released a really mocking report about the whole thing in which they basically said this thing is ridiculous, and this is clearly just a transparent bid on this young Czech politician's part for publicity, and that ultimately he's just going to run for office in the Czech Republic, which very well may be true, but actually, my impression is that he's a really sincere guy, and that this was not simply a publicity play for his own career, and that in fact he does deeply believe in this, and he thinks that disaffection with elite, distant, haughty governments all over Europe has only grown, and that he wants to set up a country that will be as a beacon unto the other nations.
I'm speaking with the writer Gideon Lewis Krauss about the Republic of Liberland. It's really a 3-square-mile patch of disputed territory between Croatia and Serbia, which one man is trying to turn into a new country. Well, one of the requirements you mentioned was that a place has to be populated, and Jedlička has put an application of citizenship for future migrants who may want to live in Liberland online. What kind of responses did he get and from whom?
This is a very interesting question, Virginia. So he put the application online, and the application is in two parts. So the first part is just a basic registration. The second part, you have to answer a whole series of questions about, do you owe money? Have you been convicted of any felons? Would you plan to be investing in Liberland? And after he put it online, in just the first couple of weeks, he got about 330,000 registrants, of whom, in the end, something like 40 to 50,000 completed the whole application. He was very surprised because he thought that the bulk of his registrants would be people from the wealthy Western nations. And that what he actually found is that almost all of them, I mean, certainly the top 5 or 6 spots came from North Africa and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That the number one by far was Egypt with about 90,000 applicants. And then after that, Turkey, which probably included a lot of Syrian migrants. And so he was kind of surprised because, as he put it, he thought that it was going to appeal to people seeking very specific freedoms from government regulation. And in fact, he found people seeking these very general freedoms from politically oppressive regimes and war. He didn't really know what to do about that because a lot of the people that he's been courting are libertarians who believe that this is going to be a nation created to beget wealth and that what they want is a principality like Liechtenstein or Monaco. And the last thing that they want are a lot of dirty migrants coming to ruin their libertarian party.
Yeah, well, nobody did want this piece of land until Jedlička declared it for Liberland. But then all of a sudden he was not the only one who wanted it. What happened?
Yes, this is a twist in his story that he declared the foundation of Liberland, and he was voted president by a vote of 2-0 by the founding committee of Liberland, which included an old university friend and his girlfriend, the first lady. And he thought that he would have time to get Liberland up and going and to assemble the government. But just days later, a Danish Bitcoin trader and former software engineer living in a small mountainous canton of Switzerland got into a car with a few former members of the Swiss army and drove 11 hours to set up their own camp on Liberland with the idea that if this was going to be a libertarian free-for-all, there was no reason for them to trust the authority of this Czech figure whom they suspected of a socialist power grab. So immediately there was a rival faction that threatened the president's authority.
Well, he's emerged as a kind of hero of Freedom Fest and other libertarian organizations and venues. After following him around, what do you think his chances are of actually making something happen with Liberland?
You know, I am not in the business of political predictions. I suspect he's going to have a very hard time convincing the Croatians to give him this piece of land. That's on their side of the river. I know that he has had contacts with the Serbian government, and so I just hope that he doesn't inadvertently start a serious international incident there.
Well, Gideon, thank you so much. What a story.
Thank you.
Gideon Lewis Krause, he's a writer and contributor to the New York Times Magazine. There's a link to read his article about Liberland at wordofmouthradio.org. And by the way, we are listening to Liberland's national anthem, which was posted to YouTube in April. It is called Victory March to Glory Land. Stay with us for two odd examples of American influence. We'll get a look at the myth behind Mexican Coke and hear a story of Cold War corn diplomacy when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1971, Coca-Cola launched the now iconic I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing, It's the Real Thing campaign. The commercials promoted peace, goodwill, and consistency to viewers inundated with daily images of Vietnam and civil discontent. The real Coke is still the best-selling soft drink in the world, and people ask for it by name. But an increasing number are turning elsewhere for it, namely south of the border. Mexican Coke, once a rarity, is now showing up all across America, from hipster bars and bodegas in Los Angeles to New England Costco shelves. But is Mexican Coke, made with cane sugar and sold in the classic contoured glass bottle, really more authentic than the American brew, made with high fructose corn syrup and often sold in plastic? Mexican Coke is featured in the American Enterprise exhibition now on at the Smithsonian, and the journalist Ann Glusker wrote about Mexican Coke for Smithsonian.com. Ann Glusker, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be here.
So, Ann, did I get that right? Is it just the sweetener and the bottle that distinguishes the American and Mexican Coke?
Exactly. It's just a question of what the sweetener is. And a lot of what my piece was about for Smithsonian was about that there's this sort of false idea, I think, out there in some parts of the food world that high fructose corn syrup is evil and sugar is better because it's quote unquote natural.
That's not true?
No, it's actually not. It's a myth. Jane Brody in the New York Times has written a lot about this. I myself, when I'm shopping for my kid, I steer well clear of anything with high fructose corn syrup in it. So I don't want to pretend that I'm a fan of high fructose corn syrup, but it's just there's this myth that sugar is better for you. It's really just any sweetener, you know, that's bad for you. There's a guy named Robert Lustig out at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, who's sort of the country's leading expert on childhood obesity. And he calls high fructose corn syrup the most demonized additive known to man. I would rather have something with sugar than a chemical, but it's not that sugar is so fantastic.
Well, so do all those who are attracted to Mexican Coke. Who is drinking Mexican Coke?
Well, I think it's a combination. I first became aware of it personally when I was living in downtown New York and, you know, it was sort of a hipster drink. You know, you go into places and there'd maybe be hand-squeezed pineapple raspberry juice and nothing chemically, and then there'd be Mexican Coke. This fairly well-known sort of pan-Asian chef named David Chang, who runs the Momofuku Noodle Bar, which is sort of a cool fusion-y place in downtown New York. He started serving Mexican Coke and caused this big explosion in the Twitter sphere because he was charging $5 a bottle or a serving or whatever it was. And so people thought that was a lot of money, but it was not widely available here when he started serving it. And so it was expensive. Now you can actually get Mexican Coke at Costco. So I think hipsters are part of who drinks Mexican Coke, but then I, you know, have a neighbor who loves it and swears by it and swears that she can taste the difference. Consumer Reports did a really interesting thing where they sort of tried to do blind taste tests and lots of people couldn't really tell. But my neighbor, after I published that piece, went on Facebook to tell me that Mexican Coke has a decidedly different mouthfeel. Mouthfeel being the sort of technical foodie word for, you know, when you taste chocolates, you know, you always talk about the mouthfeel. I'm a food person, so I sort of am familiar with that word. But when she used it, I just laughed to myself.
Well, okay, maybe the mouthfeel is different, but is American Coke with this much maligned high fructose corn syrup better or worse ethically than Mexican Coke?
Right. This article came about in relation to a Smithsonian exhibition called American Enterprise. And the curator of that exhibition, he's the one who really has some interesting thoughts on the difference in how these two substances are produced. So his point is not that it's the high fructose corn syrup that's bad ethically, but it's the sugar, interestingly, because he's saying high fructose corn syrup is produced in American factories that are worked by unionized workers who make it a living wage and, you know, are subject to all the United States OSHA, you know, the health regulations, et cetera. And that in Mexico, the sugar and agricultural industries are still pretty 19th century. It's what he calls a debt peonage system, you know, what we might have had in the U.S. after the Civil War, sharecroppers, where you're in theory free and working on your own, right? But you're always trying to pay off the rent on your little bit of land. So Peter Liebold, this curator at the Smithsonian, makes the point that it's not just a question of what you're putting in your mouth, you know, if you prefer quote unquote natural sugar to high fructose corn syrup, but that ethically, in terms of the workers who are growing it or producing it, depending on whether you're talking about the natural thing or the chemical, that, you know, they're just subject to very different kinds of working conditions, which I thought was fascinating. And honestly, I hadn't thought about until he made that point.
Right. In addition to labor, Mexican Coke is now mired in a complicated international trade situation. Now, what is going on?
Well, this is over now, but it's been going on for about the last 10 years. It seems what happened is that Mexico, like many sugar producing countries, is trying to protect its sugar industry. I mean, this, of course, goes on with many industries, right? But so they were trying to protect their sugar industry and they wanted candy makers, sweet makers, soda bottlers, not just Coke, to use sugar. That would be a way of protecting and bolstering their industry. But Coke bottlers and all these other sweets manufacturers, right, were starting to use high fructose corn syrup, less expensive, et cetera. So what Mexico wanted to do was place a tariff on the importation of high fructose corn syrup so that, you know, to discourage manufacturers from using it. The U.S. and Mexico then went before the World Trade Organization, the WTO, which is an international body, and they ruled actually that Mexico couldn't do that. So this has been going on, my guess is it'll bubble up again. This is probably just a continuing war. Because I'm a food person, I'm much more interested in the taste. You know, whenever I see that Hecho en Mexico, you know, sign on the thing, which means made in Mexico, you know, my little ears perk up. And I think many food people's ears perk up too, because they think, oh, you know, it's more authentic, it's more It's more real. The real thing is more real when it's made in Mexico.
Well, the real thing, Coke and other sweet soft drinks, have been blamed, or at least in part, for the obesity epidemic in the United States. And the New York Times Well blog recently wrote about Coca-Cola funding research that concluded that it is exercise, not diet, that's a key factor in obesity. Should we take Coke's word on nutrition?
No, we definitely should not. This organization, this new supposedly health organization called the Global Energy Balance Network, turns out to be funded by Coke, as the New York Times has revealed. And what they say is that exercise is the key to sort of a healthy weight level, not calories, not what you eat, which is just patently ridiculous. And that just clears the way for guilt-free eating of sugary foods and drinking of sugary drinks. So, of course, that's to Coke's benefit. And that's just not, that's, the science doesn't bear that out. I mean, of course, many of us who are aware of health and nutrition and exercise know that, you know, we should do both.
How about you? Have you tried Mexican Coke?
Oh, yeah. I had Mexican Coke long ago when I was living in downtown New York, and it was sort of starting to appear, you know, these sort of hipster cafe menus. And although I'm not a soda drinker, I grew up in a household with, you know, no soda, all that. My mother was very healthy. She had many other faults, but she was very healthy. And I'd see them in these sort of, you know, hip downtown New York restaurants. And I finally thought, I'll try it. And I do agree with my neighbor. I think that you could taste the difference, the mouthfeel. Although if you did a scientific double blind test and asked me to differentiate between, you know, Diet Coke, Zero Coke, Mexican Coke, I'm not sure I could do it.
If not just the taste, you propose that Mexican Coke's appeal might be more ideological. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, not so much ideological, but I think it's a, there's a feeling sort of in some parts of the food world and some parts of the population in general, some younger people, a feeling that, you know, people want authenticity, whatever. And I'm saying authenticity in quotes, right? People want what's real. Not just because Coke calls itself the real thing, but in general, you know, that we want to move back to the land, or we want to try to go off the grid, or we want to raise our own chickens. I think there are people who just feel something that is, you know, hecho en Mexico is going to be better, realer, more authentic than something made in a factory somewhere in the United States.
Journalist Anne Glusker. She wrote about Mexican Coke for Smithsonian.com, and you'll find more on it, including the American Enterprise exhibition at the Smithsonian, which features Mexican Coke. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1959, with the Cold War simmering, a new form of diplomacy and a friendship blossomed between two very unlikely people, Roswell Garst, an Iowa farmer, and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. Here with more is backstory producer Andrew Parsons.
Liz Garst was 8 years old when Khrushchev came to her grandfather Roswell's farm. She says they were oddly compatible.
I did have the impression he was like my grandfather. He was sort of loud, had a big belly laugh, and just a little bit scary.
She says Khrushchev's high profile made the day a bit of a circus. The news media swarmed the two men. And then there was the security. Her grandmother couldn't even make a simple meal for the Soviet leader without officials butting in.
As one of the security procedures, they had two food tasters, one American and one Soviet food taster, taste each dish an hour before lunch to make sure it wasn't poisoned. The whole hour before lunch, we did not let them out of our sight, just praying they would die of food poisoning. As an 8-year-old, that was just beyond exciting.
Khrushchev was on his way to Camp David to discuss pressing matters, like this big arms race that was threatening World War III. So why was it so important for him to stop in this American farm? In a word, corn.
An effort towards the goal of more and better food for Russia.
Ever since he rose to power 6 years earlier, Khrushchev had been crazy about corn. While the arms race was important, so was feeding a massive population with a long history of famine.
The goal of my father was to improve life of the Soviet people.
This is Khrushchev's son, Sergei. His father knew that in America, corn mostly fed lucrative meat and dairy industries.
So his first priority was to increase food production and at most important meat and dairy product. So the agriculture was one of his main priorities at that time.
In 1955, Khrushchev set a goal to create what he said would be an Iowa-style corn belt in the Soviet Union. 4 years before that famous televised visit, he even sent a delegation to Iowa to take some notes on how it was done. Liz Garst says that's where her grandfather first appears.
The delegation was hosted by Iowa State University, and Roswell always thought that he was way ahead on technology compared to Iowa State University.
By technology, she means hybrid corn seed, which yielded huge harvests. The problem was that the state government hadn't scheduled the Soviets to go anywhere near Garst Farm. But Garst had other plans. He intercepted the head of the delegation and invited him to tour his land the next day.
Roswell said, "So tonight, keep your mouth shut. Tomorrow morning, you load your delegation up in Iowa State's cars to go on their planned tour to Newton. And at the last minute, just refused to get in their car. And I'll drive up in my car, and I'll open up the passenger door, and you just get in my car." So that's how it happened. Roswell basically kidnapped him from underneath the nose of Iowa State.
The Soviets returned home with a 400-page report on Iowa corn, and Garst's use of hybrid seeds and nitrogen-rich fertilizer stood out. He soon found himself sitting with Nikita Khrushchev in Moscow, drawing up contracts to sell the seeds. It was in this meeting in 1955 where the two men struck up their unlikely friendship. Their surface-level motives were clear. Garst got big contracts from the Soviet government, and Khrushchev got technology that could help his massive collective farms. But Sergei Khrushchev says there was something else. The Soviet premier came from humble roots, and he really liked the image of a self-made American farmer.
And I remember Garst. He was a strong man, big, and a real American farmer, as I understood at that time, hard-working person. And my father was also a hard worker, and not only in the politics, but when he was metal worker on the factory, of course, it's increased their sympathy to each other. Two hard workers better understand each other.
But selling American farming to the Reds wasn't all smooth sailing. At first, the State Department was skeptical about Garst's adventures in the East and only reluctantly gave him the license to sell. And the Soviet Corn Belt? That didn't exactly pan out either. Liz Garst said corn was planted everywhere, including where it couldn't be sustained, like Siberia.
A common joke of this era in the Soviet Union is someone says to Mrs. Khrushchev, "Mrs. Khrushchev, your husband's planting corn every place but on the moon." And Mrs. Khrushchev says, "Shh, don't give him the idea."
And technology wasn't always applied consistently, even on fertile soil. The Soviet leader later claimed this wasn't his fault. He said in a rush to please him, the Soviets just planted hybrids too quickly in too many places. Though yields improved overall, the program wasn't nearly as successful as it should have been. Khrushchev later wrote in his memoirs, "Corn was discredited, and so was I." Garst's short-lived attempt at American farm diplomacy was a big deal in the early 50s. At the time, few Americans traveled to the Soviet Union. But by 1960, both governments had embraced the idea of cultural exchange. Khrushchev even said in 1959 that this corn diplomacy helped pave the way for his dealings with Eisenhower. His son Sergei says Garst's impact was more than just agricultural.
He became not only the farmer who sold his product. Through this, he became the politicians who just put one of the first cracks on the Iron Wall and was helping to move from the Cold War in arm race to the normal competition between two economies.
Khrushchev had used the image of Garst and of Iowa in general in state television, Soviet newspapers, and pamphlets, and it formed a lasting impression. By the 1980s, the Iron Curtain had opened wider. and the first privately owned family farm in the Soviet Union was established. Its name? Iowa.
Thank you for spending some of your weekend with Word of Mouth. If you can't listen on weekdays, you can sign up for our podcast. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org or search Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you're the sharing type, please post it for your friends on social media. We welcome you to pass it around Word of Mouth style. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.